parties expressed most memorably the loathing felt by all. "If I could not go to heaven but with a party," declared Jefferson, "I would not go at all." The seminal impulse for what was to become the Republican Party began in Virginia during the spring and summer of 1790. First, the lengthy debate in the House over slavery startled most Virginia planters, whose livelihood was switching from tobacco and wheat to the sale of their own excess slaves to the burgeoning cotton plantations of the Carolinas. The mere suggestion that the federal government could legislate slavery out of existence generated panic within the Tidewater elite who dominated Virginia politics. Second, Hamilton's financial program, especially the Assumption Bill and National Bank, signaled the triumph of Northern commerce, what Jefferson called that speculating phalanx, over Southern agriculture and Virginia's economic stature as the dominant state in the Union. Accustomed to regarding themselves as the leading citizens of the new American Republic, as Adams so nicely put it in Virginia, "all geese are swans," Virginians began to have second thoughts about the constitutional settlement of 1787 and 88, as they witnessed the emergence of a federal government moving in a direction hostile to their economic interest and beyond their political control. The key player in this unfolding drama, and the leader whose conversion to a Virginia writ large version of the nation best illustrated how the political templates were moving, was Madison. He led the fight in Congress against both federal jurisdiction over slavery and the entire Hamiltonian fiscal program. Jefferson soon joined him in mobilizing the opposition, claiming that he had been duped by Hamilton to support the Assumption Bill, and "of all the eras of my political life, this has occasioned me the deepest regret." What historians have dubbed the Great Collaboration began in earnest during the summer of 1791, when Jefferson and Madison made a so-called botanical tour up the Connecticut River to seek support in New England and New York for their agenda of opposition. Though both men were trusted members of Washington's official family, and Jefferson a key officer of the cabinet, they launched an orchestrated attack on the administration they were officially serving. Jefferson hired Philip Freneau, a prominent poet and essayist, who wrote articles in the National Gazette castigating Washington's policy of neutrality as a vile repudiation of America's obligations to France. Madison wrote several anonymous essays for the same paper, which gave a distinctive shape to the core arguments of what was beginning to be called the Republican Party. The resonant term was consolidation. Madison described the aggregation of power by the federal government as an ominous second coming on American soil of the British monster that the American Revolution had supposedly banished forever. All the familiar chords in the old revolutionary melody then played themselves out accordingly. The executive branch had become a royal court. Northern bankers were monocrats and sock jobbers who enjoyed privileged access to power at court. Hamilton's program was a homemade version of the Stamp Act. The federal government was an imperial power that treated the states as mere colonies. In effect, the money changers had taken over the American temple, and the original promise of the Revolution had fallen into enemy hands. The genius of this formulation was that it transformed a regional or sectional grievance rooted in economic interest into a patriotic rallying cry rooted in a rhetoric with all the hallowed echoes of 1776. Despite its rhetorical genius, Washington found it both flawed and fanciful. Flawed because, unlike George III in Parliament, he had been duly elected, as had all the members of Congress. And fanciful because it confused a strong executive with monarchy, almost willfully so. When Jefferson expressed his personal conviction that Hamilton had monarchical intentions, Washington countered that he did not believe that there were 10 men in the United States whose opinions were worth attention, who entertained such a thought. And Hamilton, despite his impolitic remarks on that score at the Constitutional Convention, was not one of them. More basically, Washington was immune to the virulent anti-government strain of revolutionary ideology that Jefferson and Madison were deploying because he had witnessed its consequences as commander-in-chief. The Continental Army had nearly starved to death, and the war itself had been prolonged and nearly lost, all for lack of a viable central government empowered to raise money and troops. In Washington's version of the spirit of 76, the key lesson was that independence required a fully empowered federal government, thus making his own election the proper culmination of America's revolutionary experience. Indeed, as Washington saw it, if one wished to talk about a hostile takeover of the American Revolution, the chief culprits were those Virginians, most of whom had never fired a shot in anger during the war, who were now trying to rewrite history in order to preserve their fading status and provincial privileges. Arguments about history aside, the fact remained that two of the most trusted and talented members of his inner circle were being described in the press as the general and the generalissimo of the emerging opposition party. Jefferson's continued presence in the cabinet struck several observers as the most glaring anomaly. "Beware," wrote one anonymous Washington supporter, "be on your guard. You have cherished in your bosom a serpent, and he is now endeavoring to sting you to death. His vanity makes him believe that he will certainly be your successor. Believe him not. He is a hypocrite and is deceiving you." But instead of regarding Jefferson as the serpent in the garden, Washington preferred to see him as the prodigal son who would eventually recognize the error of his ways and return to the bosom of the family. Washington's confidence in both the correctness of his political vision and the strength of his dominating personal presence made him impervious to gossip about Jefferson's duplicity. He continued to meet with Jefferson over breakfast to discuss recent dispatches from Paris or London. He continued to rely on advice from Madison and Jefferson about nettlesome details related to the construction of the city going up on the Potomac. The criticism of his policies that they were drafting or sponsoring in other quarters never came up, by mutual consent. The psychological minuet had its corollary on the other side. Whenever Washington unburdened himself in private conversations with Jefferson or Madison about his physical fatigue, his declining energy, his insatiable urge for retirement to Mount Vernon, they recorded their recollections of the conversation as evidence of his growing mental detachment from the duties of the office. In effect, they apparently convinced themselves, and left a written record of their conviction, that the aging patriarch was not really in charge or fully responsible for the policies going forward under the protection of his own name. The satanic presence and true power behind the scene was, they believed, Hamilton. This somewhat strained interpretation of Washington's genuine fatigue had two huge advantages. At the personal level, it allowed Jefferson and Madison to argue that they were not betraying their venerable father figure, who simply did not know what was going on. At a public level, it allowed for a distinction between their criticism of the Washington administration and of Washington himself, thereby avoiding the politically insurmountable task of taking on the most beloved and respected hero of the age. Washington danced his own minuet throughout the summer of 1792, hoping against hope that it would carry him southward toward Mount Vernon. Ironically, it was Jefferson who most candidly informed him that the sectional tensions created by Virginia's reaction to the Hamiltonian program rendered all such hopes superfluous. "North and South will hang together," Jefferson warned, "only if they have you to hang on." Though he himself planned to retire soon, Jefferson explained that Washington was not permitted the same luxury. "There is sometimes an eminence of character in which society have such peculiar claims as to control the predilection of the individual. This seems to be your condition." When Washington asked Tobias Lear to inquire discreetly about alternative candidates, Lear reported that "no other person is contemplated." Even as late as November, with the election imminent, Washington apparently clung to the illusion that he still had a choice in the matter. At least he told the prominent Philadelphia socialite Elizabeth Willing Powell that a second term remained inconceivable to both him and Martha. Powell reiterated Jefferson's warning about sectional tensions, noting that Washington's departure would be used as an argument for dissolving the Union. She then went on to offer perhaps the most psychologically astute diagnosis of Washington's unique status by any of his contemporaries. "Be assured that a great deal of the well-earned popularity you are now in possession of will be torn from you by the envious and malignant should you follow the bent of your inclinations. You know human nature too well not to believe that you have enemies. Merit and virtue, when placed on an eminence, will as certainly attract envy as the magnet does the needle." In short, his host of admirers included ambitious men whose admiration barely concealed their latent hatred of his greater greatness. As long as he retained power, they would be afraid to show themselves, but they were lurking in the background, poised to ravage his reputation and render his retirement less serene than he envisioned. Washington took it all in and remained silent. Once again, he did not need to declare his candidacy. By keeping Madison's draft of his valedictory address in his drawer, his candidacy was presumed. Once again, the electoral vote was unanimous. His second inaugural address accurately expressed his mood. It was the briefest in presidential history, only two short paragraphs long, wholly devoid of content, respectful but regretful in tone. Up as a mark. If Washington originally approached his presidency as a mandatory sentence ironically imposed on him for good behavior, the second term began as pure purgatory. And before the year was out, events seemed to be tumbling toward hell. On the southern frontier, McGillivray's stabilizing influence eroded under Spanish prodding and bribes, producing violent clashes with white settlers from Kentucky to Florida. The Six Nations tried but failed to exercise control over the Ohio tribes, whose leaders declared war on any person of a white skin entering what they called our island. The French Revolution moved from liberty, equality, and fraternity to the guillotine, and Lafayette, fleeing the chaos, was captured and placed in an Austrian dungeon. Farmers in western Pennsylvania staged mass protests against an excise tax on whiskey, claiming it was an updated version of the Stamp Act. A yellow fever epidemic broke out in Philadelphia, forcing the government to take up makeshift quarters in Germantown. And the battle within the cabinet between Jefferson and Hamilton escalated, ending only at the end of the year when Jefferson took his wounds and principles back home to Monticello and retirement. More personally, Washington's favorite nephew, who was responsible for managing Mount Vernon, died of tuberculosis. A cancer-like growth appeared on Washington's right cheek, requiring another debilitating surgery. Finally, while Hamilton remained the chief villain in Republican editorials, the moratorium on Washington himself ended as both Freneau's National Gazette and Benjamin Franklin Bache's Aurora began targeting him as either a senile accomplice or a willing co-conspirator in the Hamiltonian plot to establish an American monarchy. Washington found the personal attacks outrages on common decency, but resolved to suffer in silence. "The arrows of malevolence," he observed, "however barbed and well-pointed, never can reach the most vulnerable part of me, though while I am up as a mark, they will be continually aimed." He would, in fact, be up as a mark for the remainder of his presidency. He would also be enveloped by foreign policy challenges and their domestic ramifications. The cataclysmic event that shaped his political agenda occurred in April 1793, when war broke out between Great Britain and revolutionary France. Washington immediately recognized the threatening implications of this resumption of a century-old conflict between the two contending powers of Europe, this time with France brandishing its revolutionary obligation to extend an empire of liberty around the globe. As soon as the news arrived, he convened the cabinet, Jefferson had yet to depart, and extracted their unanimous support for a policy of strict American neutrality, which was released to the world as an executive proclamation the following week. But what was intended to sound a clear and conclusive note turned out to be just the start of a cacophonous story. In a remarkably convenient sense, the interlacing strands of the story assumed a palpable shape in the recently arrived minister from France, Edmond Genet. Citizen Genet, the title a measure of France's current intoxication with egalitarianism, arrived in America brimming over with assurance that there could be no such thing as neutrality when the cause of liberty was on the march. Several conversations with Jefferson confirmed his conviction that the spiritual bonds uniting the Americans with the French Revolution were more powerful than any presidential proclamation. A series of essays in the National Gazette reinforced this impression, arguing that the historic link between America and France, codified in the Franco-American Treaty of 1778, could not be repudiated by any executive decision. Genet then unburdened himself in a flurry of pronouncements that effectively doomed his mission. Outfitting American privateers to oppose British control of the seas, scheming to send an expedition to seize control of New Orleans from Spain in the name of the Franco-American alliance, and most preposterously, announcing that he, Citizen Genet, spoke for the true interests of the American people and urging Congress to override Washington's proclamation at its next session. By then, even Jefferson acknowledged privately that Genet, originally seen as an invaluable ally, had become an albatross for the Republican opposition. For his part, Washington confided to friends that no official rejection of Genet was necessary, since the man's own suicidal instincts would suffice. But the Genet affair exposed for the first time that foreign policy had become inextricably entangled with partisan politics. Genet's behavior was wildly irresponsible. But the cause of France was also wildly popular in 1793, producing mass demonstrations demanding war with Great Britain, and activist organizations called democratic societies that modeled themselves on the old Sons of Liberty. These were powerful sentiments with resonant echoes of 76 that the Republicans were determined to exploit, in part because it was good politics, in part because many Republicans, Jefferson for one, believed in them passionately. Washington was absolutely certain, and history eventually proved him right, that America's long-term interest was best served by steering a neutral course that avoided war with any of the European powers. He was also convinced that his Republican opponents were manipulating popular opinion toward France as a political weapon. "It is not the cause of France, nor I believe liberty, which they regard," he observed, "for could they involve the country in war, no matter with whom, and disgrace, they would be among the first and loudest of the clamorers against the expense and impolicy of the measure." And yet, while determined to have his own realistic assessment of America's interests prevail, the reigning romance of all things French gave the Republican press new ammunition to depict him as an arbitrary monarch rather than a far-sighted leader. Perhaps to offset the charges, he made a point at the height of the Genet affair of questioning his own authority to convene Congress in Germantown because of the yellow fever epidemic. Such modest gestures went unnoticed in the National Gazette and Aurora, where Washington himself now replaced Hamilton as the central target. Another event had nostalgic implications, for it played out in the western counties of Pennsylvania, where Washington's military career had begun 40 years earlier. The story had its origins in 1791, when Congress passed an excise tax on whiskey to help pay the debt created by Hamilton's funding and assumption program. Protests against the tax by western grain farmers followed immediately, claiming that it fell disproportionately on distilleries making the whiskey that allowed them to transport their product to eastern markets. Despite Washington's efforts to work through the courts to punish offenders, resistance to the tax was so widespread that collectors were forced to flee for their lives. The protest movement culminated in August 1794, when more than 6,000 men gathered in Braddock's Field outside Pittsburgh, very near the scene of the Monongahela massacre. They set up mock guillotines to register their solidarity with French revolutionaries, imbibed freely of their favorite liquid, then defied the federal government to come after them. "Should an attempt be made to suppress these people," warned one witness, "I am afraid the question will not be whether you will march to Pittsburgh, but whether they will march to Philadelphia." The rebels saw themselves, as had the Shays' rebels in Massachusetts nearly a decade earlier, as actors in a dramatic sequel to the resistance movement against arbitrary taxation. I consider this insurrection as the first formidable fruit of the democratic societies, Washington insisted, meaning that it was inspired more by the French than the American Revolution, and was encouraged by Republican operatives in Pennsylvania. He had earlier described military action against the rebels as a dernier resort, but by September 1794 concluded that rebel intransigence left him no alternative, claiming that these self-created societies, he nearly spit out the words, represented a tyranny of the minority against the will of the majority, and that their only revolutionary principle was that every man can cut and carve for himself. Moreover, he decided to take personal command of the 13,000 troops raised by militia enlistments to crush the insurrection. This decision produced a scene that provides the most graphic and dramatic illustration of the two competing versions of what the American Revolution had come to mean in the 1790s. On one side stood the rebels, a defiant collection of aggrieved farmers, emboldened by their conviction that the excise tax levied by Congress was every bit as illegitimate as the taxes levied by the British ministry. On the other side stood Washington and his Federalized troops, an updated version of the Continental Army, marching west to enforce the authority of the constitutionally elected government that claimed to represent all the American people. It was the spirit of 76 against the spirit of 87, one historic embodiment of the people against another. And there was Washington, back in the saddle again as commander-in-chief, with former aide-de-camp Hamilton at his side, traveling on the old Forbes Road he had objected to so strenuously as a route in his earlier incarnation as a soldier. It also turned out to be the first and only time a sitting American president led troops in the field. In truth, Washington only accompanied the army as far as Carlisle. By then it was clear that the bravado of the rebels had evaporated at the approach of such a formidable force. Hamilton led the army in what became a triumphant parade to Pittsburgh, obeying Washington's orders to offer amnesty to all rebels who signed an oath to obey the laws of the federal government. Back in Philadelphia, Washington addressed Congress, justifying his military response on the grounds that certain self-created societies were, in fact, subversive organizations that threatened the survival of the National Union. He was not disputing the right of aggrieved citizens to dissent, but he was insisting that dissent could not take the form of flagrant violation of federal authority. Congress overwhelmingly agreed, congratulating him on defending the Constitution. Only Madison struck a sour note in an uncharacteristically rambling speech that worried about the precedent this set. Down at Monticello, the recently retired Jefferson confided to Madison that the Republican cause had suffered a massive blow, but that Washington on horseback trumped anything they could muster in response. A close reading of Washington's speech to Congress somewhat consoled him, wrote Jefferson, since the language resembled shreds of stuff from Aesop's Fables and Tom Thumb, which he interpreted as evidence that Hamilton composed it, so that the grand old man probably did not know what he was doing or saying. Finally, the greatest crisis of the Washington presidency was the debate over the Jay Treaty. It seems safe to say no treaty in American history generated so many diplomatic, constitutional, and political reverberations. And no treaty so unpopular in its own day proved so beneficial over the stretch of time. What Hamilton's financial program was to the first term, the Jay Treaty was to the second. A projection of executive power that most infuriated Washington's enemies. Unlike the Hamilton program, which bore only his signature, Washington's distinctive mark on the Jay Treaty was conspicuously registered at every step of the lengthy and anguishing process. It was his most besieged and finest hour. Here is the essential background. By 1794, the prospects of war with Great Britain were approaching a crisis. In defiance of the Treaty of Paris, British troops had remained stationed on the northwestern frontier, justified as a strategic response to America's refusal to compensate British creditors for pre-revolutionary debts. Virginia's planter class owed the bulk of the money. Merely as a symbol, the British military presence suggested a hovering reminder that American victory in the War of Independence was still incomplete. More substantively, British troops were encouraging the Ohio tribes to defy Washington's efforts at accommodation. The outbreak of war between Britain and France had escalated the tensions, in part because the sentiments of the American citizenry were decidedly pro-French, and in part because British cruisers were scooping up American merchant vessels in the Caribbean with impunity in an effort to block all trade with France. In April 1794, Washington dispatched Chief Justice John Jay to London to negotiate a realistic bargain that would remove the British troops and redefine commercial relations with Britain in terms that avoided war. This last item was most crucial in Washington's mind. Whatever unfinished business remained between the two former adversaries, Washington believed that America could not afford to risk war with the British Army or Navy for at least a generation, or, as he put it, for about 20 years. A war before then would be economically and militarily disastrous. It also had the potential to kill the infant nation in the cradle. These were sensible and far-sighted goals. Indeed, the War of 1812 arrived right on Washington's schedule. But at the time, the very thought of negotiating with the British was wildly unpopular. The selection of Jay also created a furor within the Virginia camp, because he was known to favor payment of the long-standing debts to British creditors that Virginians preferred to finesse. Madison denounced Jay's selection as a diabolical choice, though he confidentially noticed a silver lining in this dark cloud, namely, Jay's unpopularity was likely to rub off on Washington and render the impregnable hero suddenly vulnerable. Bache's Aurora joined the chorus of criticism, going so far as to suggest that Jay had been chosen because sending the Chief Justice to London would make impeachment proceedings against Washington impossible. This was preposterous, to be sure, but also an accurate barometer of the fanatical atmosphere surrounding the issues at stake. The terms Jay was able to negotiate only made matters worse. On the positive side, the treaty required the removal of British troops from the frontier, and it committed the British to arbitrate American claims of compensation for cargoes confiscated by their navy. But otherwise, the terms were decidedly unfavorable. Accepting British economic and naval supremacy in language that gave American neutrality a British tilt. Critics could plausibly argue, and Jefferson did, that the treaty created a neo-colonial status for the United States within the British Empire. Advocates might have responded that American merchants would be the chief beneficiaries of this arrangement, which only codified diplomatically what was already a fact commercially. Trade with Great Britain was the lifeblood of the American economy. But this would only become clear later. In any event, the Republican press had a field day as soon as the terms of the treaty were leaked to the Aurora and made public. Jay claimed he could have walked the entire eastern seaboard at night and had his way illuminated by protesters burning him in effigy. Adams later recalled that the presidential mansion in Philadelphia was surrounded by innumerable multitudes from day to day, buzzing, demanding war against England, cursing Washington, and crying success to the French patriots and virtuous Republicans. Washington believed that Jay had probably gotten the best terms possible, and while not all that he had hoped for, the treaty averted a popular but misguided war and preserved economic relations with America's major trading partner. But he also conceded that, at present, the cry against the treaty is like that against a mad dog, and everyone in a manner seems engaged in running it down. Should he sign it? Strategically, he thought the treaty was a sensible compromise with British power that bought precious time for America to mature toward its own destiny as a player on the world stage. Politically, his cabinet was divided, and letters were pouring in from around the country describing the treaty as a pact with the British Satan. Though he was probably leaning toward a positive decision, what pushed him over the edge was a dramatic crisis in his cabinet that graphically exposed the conspiratorial mentality of the treaty's opponents. Edmund Randolph, who succeeded Jefferson as Secretary of State, had opposed the treaty. In August 1795, Washington was shown confidential documents exposing Randolph's off-the-record conversations with the outgoing French minister Joseph Fouché. Although it is unlikely that Randolph requested a bribe to assist the French cause, as some documents seem to imply, the whole tenor of his remarks conveyed the impression that Washington was a dazed, over-the-hill patriarch, the dupe of scheming northern bankers and closet monarchists who were plotting to capture the Republic for their own sinister purposes. As Randolph described the executive branch, only his own patriotic influence within the cabinet offered any prospect of rescuing the presidency from ruin. This, in effect, was Jefferson talk, the kind of overheated and melodramatic depiction of the purported evil lurking in Washington's administration that passed for self-evident truths within Republican headquarters in Virginia. The conspiratorial mentality was so widespread within the Virginia camp that Randolph had lost all perspective on how conspiratorial it sounded to those denied the vision. Washington demanded Randolph's resignation on the spot and signed the Jay Treaty the next day. But the story did not end there. Jefferson could not believe that a treaty so unpopular could ever become law, since it was, as he said, really nothing more than a treaty of alliance between England and the Anglo-men of this country against the legislature and people of the United States. Though the Constitution nowhere specifically mentioned it, Jefferson persuaded himself that the true meaning of the Constitution gave the House of Representatives sovereign power over all legislation, including treaties. Madison's more oblique but cunning formulation was that the House, which had authority over all money bills, could sabotage the Jay Treaty by denying the funds necessary for its implementation. The drama played out in the House in the spring of 1796. During the debate, Robert Livingston of New York requested that Washington hand over all documents related to the treaty, implying that full disclosure would reveal mischief behind the scenes. Washington rejected the request as a dangerous precedent that violated the separation of powers doctrine by extending congressional scrutiny into the executive branch. He also inquired on what grounds the House claimed any role in approving treaties. Undeterred, Madison pressed on as the floor leader in the debate, confident that he had the votes to carry the day regardless of constitutional niceties. As the votes began to melt away, Madison experienced firsthand the humiliation that befell anyone who went up against Washington in a political battle he was determined to win. The treaty passed by a slim majority, 51-48, on the last day of April. As he surveyed the wreckage from Monticello, Jefferson tried to console Madison with the observation that Washington's stature alone caused the defeat, for he was the one man who outweighs them all in influence over all the people. He quoted a famous line from Joseph Addison's Cato, Washington's favorite play, and applied it to Washington himself. "A curse on his virtues! They have undone his country!" In the Jeffersonian formulation, Washington remained a marvelously well-intentioned but quasi-senile front man for a Federalist conspiracy, inadvertently lending his enormous credibility to the treacheries being hatched all around him. For his part, Washington described the Republican campaign against the Jay Treaty as a blatantly partisan effort masquerading as a noble cause, one that somehow the Virginians had convinced themselves was in the national and not just their regional interest. With respect to the motives which have led to these measures, and which have not only brought the Constitution to the brink of precipice, put the happiness and prosperity of the country into imminent danger, I shall say nothing. Charity tells us they ought to be good, but suspicions say they must be bad. At present, my tongue shall be quiet. He confessed to Jay that the vicious personal attacks and willful misrepresentations that dominated the debate were ominous signs of a new kind of party politics for which he had no stomach. "These things, as you have supposed, fill my mind with much concern and with serious anxiety. Indeed, the trouble and perplexities which they occasion, added to the weight of years which have passed over me, have worn away my mind more than my body, and renders ease and retirement indisputably necessary to both during the short time I have to stay here." The Farewell. The debate over the Jay Treaty exposed the major fault line running through the entire Revolutionary era. On one side stood those who wished America's revolutionary energies to be harnessed to the larger purpose of nation-building. On the other side stood those who interpreted that very process as a betrayal of the revolution itself. Washington did not try to straddle that divide in the Jay Treaty debate or delegate the front-line position in the battle to surrogates. Just as he had at Trenton and Princeton during the war, he took the lead. But what no British musket or cannon had been able to do on the military battlefield, the Republican press had managed to accomplish on the political one. Washington was wounded, struck in the spot he cared about most passionately. His reputation as the singular figure who embodied the meaning of the American Revolution in its most elevated and transcendent form. The partisan character of the debate over the Jay Treaty rendered all claims to transcendence obsolete. Washington could neither accept that fact nor ignore the wounds that this new form of politics had inflicted on him and on his legacy. The personal attacks became even more savage in the summer of 1796. In response to the Jay Treaty, the French Directory had declared commercial war on American shipping. And one of the first prizes captured was an American cruiser, coincidentally named the Mount Vernon. Editorials in the Aurora, taking a line that would have been regarded as treasonable in any later international conflict, saluted the French campaign on the high seas and chortled over the capture of a ship associated with Washington's reputation. Bache subsequently launched a direct assault on Washington's character by printing documents purporting to show that the president had accepted a bribe from the British early in the Revolutionary War, so that all along he had really been a British spy in the Benedict Arnold mode. This bizarre charge was based on British forgeries during the war, which had long ago been exposed as part of a British scheme to have Washington removed as commander-in-chief. Washington tried to laugh off the smear campaign, observing that Bache has a celebrity in a certain way, for his calumnies are to be exceeded only by his impudence, and both stand unrivaled. But in the supercharged atmosphere of the time, all political attacks, no matter how preposterous, enjoyed some claim on credibility. Washington spent several days assuring that the official record of the British forgeries was put on file in the archives of the State Department. Another painful wound that he felt personally was Jefferson's betrayal. Even though Jefferson had been describing him in private correspondence as quasi-senile, Washington learned of these charges from second-hand sources whom he chose not to believe. And Jefferson had taken care to assure that his own fingerprints were never left on any public documents. Indeed, when he retired from the cabinet late in 1793, Washington made a point of saluting Jefferson's integrity and the personal trust that remained intact despite the policy differences between them. At some level, Washington knew full well that Jefferson was orchestrating the Republican campaign against his presidency. But at another level, Jefferson remained one of his cherished surrogate sons, perhaps prodigal, surely misguided in his romantic attachments to France and to a Virginia writ large vision of the American Republic, but cherished nonetheless. Both men desperately wished to preserve the semblance of mutual trust and friendship. The break came in July 1796. Perhaps out of a sense of guilt, perhaps because he realized how thoroughly his duplicity had been exposed, Jefferson wrote to offer assurances that he had played no direct role in the recent press attacks on Washington's character. Washington's response was a masterful example of how one Virginia gentleman tells another that he has violated the unspoken code. "As you have mentioned the subject yourself, it would not be frank, candid, or friendly to conceal that your conduct has been represented as derogatory from that opinion I had conceived you entertained to me. He then proceeded to list the litany of libels in the Aurora, accusations that could scarcely be applied to a Nero, a notorious defaulter, or even to a common pickpocket. Then came the devastating clincher. Though everyone had been warning him about Jefferson, my answer invariably has been that I had never discovered anything in the conduct of Mr. Jefferson to raise suspicions in my mind of his sincerity. From that moment, Jefferson knew that Washington no longer trusted him. The two men exchanged a few more letters the following year, all safely focused on agrarian topics like their respective vetch crops. Then, when one of Jefferson's more offensive private letters condemning Washington's leadership was reprinted in the newspapers, Jefferson claimed it was not quite what he had said, all correspondence between Monticello and Mount Vernon ceased. Historians have always had a difficult time trying to pinpoint the moment when the party system displaced a government founded on trust and by partisan assumptions. For Washington, this was it. By then, Washington had already asked his other surrogate son to draft what came to be called the Farewell Address. Hamilton had left the cabinet more than a year earlier, but had remained Washington's chief advisor throughout the Jay Treaty imbroglio. He also had more experience than anyone else at crafting language for Washington's signature. In this instance, Washington let it be known from the start that more than his signature would be required on this final statement of his public career. He sent Hamilton a first draft comprised of his own words, plus Madison's valedictory address of 1792, along with extensive instructions about content and style. On the latter score, he insisted on a conspicuously plain style that could be handed to the public in an honest, unaffected, simple garb. No amount of special pleading could change his mind this time about retirement, and Hamilton did not even try. But the announcement must in its very tone and language be discernibly Republican. While the very act of stepping down voluntarily put the lie to the incessant charges that he harbored monarchical ambitions, the style itself must make the same anti-monarchical point. The inclusion of Madison's draft from 4 years earlier was both ironic and essential. Ironic because Madison had long since gone over to the other side and become Jefferson's most invaluable acolyte. And essential because Washington wanted to remind all concerned that he had attempted to retire after his first term. By including the Madison draft, he undermined the claim currently circulating in the Republican press that he was now being forced out against his will and would be defeated if he ran again. This was a ludicrous claim, since Washington would have won another election handily, though not unanimously. But he was in a vulnerable frame of mind and wanted to leave nothing to chance. It was imperative that his decision to step down be perceived as a voluntary act, another dramatic surrender of power in the Cincinnatus mode, his last and greatest exit. The draft Washington sent to Hamilton contained the following passage, which never made it into the final version of the farewell address. Hamilton saw to that, but provides a revealing glimpse into his battered, thoroughly exhausted emotional condition at the time. "I did not seek the office with which you have honored me, and now can show only the gray hairs of a man who has either in a civil or military character spent 45 years, all the prime of his life, in serving his country, who only wanted to be suffered to pass quietly to the grave, and that his errors, however numerous, if they are not criminal, may be consigned to the tomb of oblivion, as he himself will soon be to the mansion of retirement. This was all wrong. Plaintive, self-pitying, verging on pathetic. It conveyed the impression of an aging patriarch beyond his prime, just the kind of image Jefferson had been whispering behind the scenes for years. One of Hamilton's major responsibilities was to assure that the grand old man of the Revolutionary era appear more grand than old. In this final performance on the public stage, Washington did not need to be coached. He knew what he wanted to say. But Hamilton needed to ensure that the script moved forward in stately and dignified cadences. Hamilton also realized that he was being asked to write for posterity. "It has been my object to render this act importantly and lastingly useful," he confided to Washington, "and to embrace such reflections and sentiments as will wear well, progress in approbation with time, and redound to future reputation." This was precocious on Hamilton's part, though not even he could have predicted the impact his words would have over the ages. Several drafts were exchanged between the two men in late summer of 1796, with Washington deleting several passages, making marginal additions in pencil, and warning Hamilton to mark all revisions so that no last-minute changes could be smuggled in without his approval. When the final draft was ready for the printer in September, Washington sat with the text as the presses were being set and made changes in 174 out of the 1,086 lines in his own hand, a final scan, so the printer reported, in which he was very minute. It seems fair to resolve the perennial question about authorship of the farewell address by concluding that it was a collaborative effort, in which Hamilton was the draftsman who wrote most of the words, while Washington was the author whose ideas prevailed throughout. It should also be noticed in passing that the document is somewhat misleadingly titled, since it was never delivered as an address or speech. Better to think of it as an open letter to the American people, published in newspapers throughout the country in the fall of 1796, offering Washington's distilled wisdom on what he regarded as the true meaning of the American Revolution. Sifting through the mound of scholarship that has built up around the farewell address over the past two centuries is a bit like joining an archaeological dig. Each generation has discovered meanings that speak to its own problems. All generations have labeled it an American classic, though for different reasons. The central interpretive strain, however, has been to read the farewell address as the seminal statement of American isolationism. Ironically, the phrase most associated with this interpretive tradition, entangling alliances with none, is not present in the farewell address. Double irony, it appears in Jefferson's first inaugural of all places. Here are the salient words, which isolationists hurled against Woodrow Wilson in 1917 and Franklin Roosevelt in 1941. "Europe has a set of primary interests, which to us have none or a very remote relation. Hence, she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are foreign to our concerns. 'Tis our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world." In truth, Washington's isolationist prescription rests atop a deeper message about American foreign policy, which deserves more recognition than it has received as the seminal statement in the realistic tradition. Here are the key words. "There can be no greater error to expect or calculate upon real favors from nation to nation. 'Tis an illusion which experience must cure, which a just pride ought to discard." Washington was saying that the relationship between nations was not like the relationship between individuals, which could periodically be conducted on the basis of mutual trust. Nations always had and always would behave solely on the basis of interest. It followed that all treaties were merely temporary arrangements destined to be discarded once those interests shifted. In the context of his own time, this was a defense of the Jay Treaty, which repudiated the Franco-American alliance and aligned America's commercial interests with British markets, as well as the protection of the all-powerful British fleet. It was also a rejection of Jefferson's love affair with the French Revolution as a sentimental attachment, temporarily buoyed by popular opinion, but blissfully oblivious to the long-term interests of the American public. In the larger historical context, the isolationist message was intended to have a limited lifespan that would last through the gestative phase of domestic expansion in the 19th century. The realistic message, on the other hand, was Washington's eternal principle intended to endure forever. Looking backward, it links Washington with the classical values advocated by Thucydides in the Melian Dialogue. Looking forward, it connects the farewell address with the foreign policy perspective of the likes of Hans Morgenthau,